Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and in this half-hour segment, we're going to continue with our analysis of a possible biological warfare component to Persian Gulf War Syndrome. In our previous segment, we listened to a portion of an interview with Dr. Garth Nicholson, who, along with his wife, Dr. Nancy Nicholson, has done some seminal research on the apparent role of a genetically engineered microorganism known as a mycoplasma in Persian Gulf War Syndrome. Some people at Walter Reed Army Hospital in Washington have now expressed an interest in following up on Dr. Nicholson's research, which indicates that this mycoplasma, not only a mycoplasma, but a genetically engineered mycoplasma with a gene from HIV spliced into it, may very well account for a significant portion of the Persian Gulf War Syndrome sufferers. This radio symposium, in which Dr. Nicholson is interviewed, was broadcast on October 20th, 1996, on my home base station, KFJC-FM. In addition to Dr. Nicholson, the symposium featured Dr. Alan Cantwell, the author of, among other titles, AIDS and the Doctors of Death, Dr. Leonard Horowitz, the author of Emerging Viruses, AIDS and Ebola, Nature, Accident, or Intentional, and Ed Haslam, the author of Mary, Fairy, and the Monkey Virus. We're going to continue with the interview with Dr. Garth Nicholson. This interview was begun in our previous half-hour segment, and again, this deals with an apparently genetically engineered mycoplasma. Dr. Nicholson, with regard to this this mycoplasma, now, am I incorrect in assuming that you believe it was genetically engineered?
Well, we think it was modified by insertion of specific genes to make it more pathogenic. That's the only logical explanation, because we don't find any of the other HIV-1 genes present in the organism. We only find the envelope gene, and we've looked for some of the other genes. Now, if this were an organism that, say, had picked up an HIV-1 virus, you'd expect to find at least traces of some of the other genes, but we can't find any. So it's a very suspicious finding. It's a very suspicious result, and it suggests that this thing may have been modified to make it more pathogenic. And by the way, that's exactly the gene, of all the genes in the HIV genome, that's the gene that you would use if you wanted to weaponize this microorganism. So it's very suspicious, and we strongly suspect that it was modified in the laboratory.
Do you believe that this organism may have been utilized in any of the perhaps experiments in the United States? We've been talking about the inoculation of people in institutions for people who are, quote, mentally retarded, unquote, and the use of various captive populations for experimentation. Do you believe that perhaps this might have been, this organism might have been tested on people or institutions in the United States or elsewhere?
Yes, I do. We have some evidence that it may have been used in the United States before Desert Storm. In fact, we've been working with several groups of prison guards and their family members. And these guards and their family members had come down with Gulf War illness before the Gulf War, and this has now been certified by environmental physicians who've carefully examined them, and they've indicated, yes, they did have all the signs and symptoms expected for Gulf War illness, only they had it before the Gulf War. And it's interesting that the units, particularly in Texas, where we have the most information, that these guards served at were units that were taking part in experimental testing programs under DOD-sponsored vaccine development. And we strongly suspect that some of these things may have been tested in the prison population. And then the guards picked them up because they are contagious, and then their family members picked them up. And so when we were working with these groups of guards and their family members, we found that they not only had the same microorganism but with the same inserted gene, but they recovered the same after the antibiotic treatment with doxycycline, azithromycin, ciprofloxacin, and other antibiotics that we've used. And a lot of their signs and symptoms, they had these very unusual neurologic signs and symptoms with a lot of neuropathies and so on, and that all went away with successful treatment, just like we found in the soldiers. So we not only found the same organism, but it responded the same way to antibiotics, and these people are getting better now. So this was very suspicious since it went on before the war.
Now, it's common knowledge to those who are familiar with national security affairs and also the underlying history of the Persian Gulf War and Saddam Hussein's weapons buildup that basically his armaments came from the West as a result of covert operations which channeled his munitions of various types, including weapons of mass destruction, nuclear, chemical, biological,
Do you think it would be reasonable to equate that apparent use of this organism in tests on prison populations in the United States with its presence in the Persian Gulf War and it turning up in U.S. troops and the clandestine weapons, clandestine armament, arming of Saddam Hussein? What I'm really driving at here is, do you think that the organism which wound up in U.S. troops may have originally come from us?
Well, I think that's a very good possibility. And, of course, some of the evidence that the United States supplied the Iraqis with biological weapons comes from the Senate Banking Committee. Senator Regel's committee had documented the transfer of, at the time, they considered dual-use biologic agents, such as anthrax, botulism, so on and so forth. These agents, bacterial for the most part, are known to be useful for biological weaponry. And we think the Iraqis probably developed some of this for their own biological weapons programs. They had a number of experts in institutions in Iraq that were capable of doing this type of research. And as a matter of fact, at the University of Baghdad for the last 22 years, they had a mycoplasma unit. And in fact, practically all the members of that unit were trained here in the United States. And some of them trained in U.S. Government laboratories like at Plum Island. And these researchers had built this very large mycoplasma unit, and I find it hard to believe that Saddam Hussein would have this large unit in Baghdad unless it had some other purpose. And I think that purpose may have been biological warfare development.
By the way, I want to invite the other participants in our program to comment and to interject as they see fit. I know that we have an article here from the Oakland Tribune talking about, this is from the Oakland Tribune of Thursday, October 17th, talking about Saddam's arsenal had time bombs for liver cancer. And this is obviously, I'm not familiar with the genesis of liver cancer. One of the things that I would like to eventually get into, as our participants see fit, and that is some discussion not only of this mycoplasma, but Alan Cantwell, you have developed research indicating a cancer microbe. Now, not a virus, but another type of organism.
Yeah, Dr. Nicholson, Alan Cantwell here. I think you might be familiar with my research, particularly in Kaposi sarcoma, showing bacteria in the tissue, which seem to be perhaps cell wall deficient bacteria that can be seen microscopically. I was just curious, and this cancer microbe concept, which I know is anathema to the medical profession, certainly this cancer microbe, according to people who have studied it, has a mycoplasma type phase. I was curious if you thought this could be in any way related to the kind of bacteria that have been associated with cancer.
Well, it might be. Of course, in AIDS patients, as Montagnier has found, this same type of microorganism, Mycoplasma fermentans incognitus, seems to be present in almost half of the terminal AIDS patients, and it seems to be causing a lot of the morbidity in AIDS. And so I think it could just be another example of what happens when somebody gets riddled with an illness. They pick up some of these infections, and we don't know exactly in the case of cancer whether there's a cause and effect or whether it's a cofactor. I don't know that we know at this time, but I think it certainly can cause a lot of damage. It's known to be a co-carcinogen. There were some experiments published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Science last year that the very same organism that I've been talking about can be put in with human cells and culture, and it can act as a very potent co-carcinogen. So it certainly is a very suspicious organism, and it can certainly cause a lot of damage.
I have a burning question as far as the epidemiology of this disease and trying to determine whether it's something that Saddam Hussein did or something that may we have done through vaccines. And that, of course, is, does this disease exist in the Iraqis or in the Saudis? Certainly, if something blew up and it contaminated the area, you would think that people living there would have this disease too. Is there any evidence that they do have this disease?
We had a visitor who was actually a relative of Saddam Hussein. He was a military attaché in Washington who came down and visited us when we were still in Houston. And he was a very high officer in the Iraqi army, and he flat out told us that there were 300,000 dead and over a million people sick from the release of chemical and biological weapons in southern Iraq. Now, we have no way to confirm what he told us, but it was quite dramatic and quite shocking. Some members of my laboratory have actually called around to various clinics in Jordan, Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, and contrary to the official stand, that is the official line from the ministries of health of these countries, when you talk to people in the clinics, they tell you that 15 to 20% of the entire population of these countries, that is the countries surrounding Iraq, are now riddled with Gulf War illness. So it is in the populations. We think that it's probably going to spread. It's going to spread all around, eventually around the world, unless we recognize it and do something to combat it.
Why do you think the media is silent about this possibility?
Well, for one thing, there's kind of been a media blackout on this, and people have told us that there was actually a federal gag order on biological weapons in Desert Storm. I really don't know that. I don't really have any way to confirm that. But they've always acted a little bit suspicious to me, at least the mainstream media, because they get quite interested in the story, and then they tell me, well, the people upstairs are, you know, told me to lay off the story or whatever, and that's always kind of suspicious, you know, that the press is really very manipulable in this country. It's surprising.
I had a question, Dr. Nicholson. Throughout the course of the discussion this evening, we've been talking about contaminated vaccines, either accidental and or deliberate, and their role in developing, if the panel would inform me of the pronunciation, man-made or accidental man-made disease, I-A-T-R-O-G-E-N-I-C?
Iatrogenic.
Iatrogenic, okay. The possibility of iatrogenic diseases or deliberately diseases that were deliberately inoculated into people via vaccines. The soldiers who served in the Persian Gulf had a tremendous number of vaccinations administered to them. Do you feel there could be any possible connection?
Well, there is a possible connection. That's why I mentioned it. And there are some very suspicious things that happened during the Gulf conflict. One of the suspicious things that happened was the fact that most of the soldiers' shot records had disappeared. And this is the first conflict in the history, in recent history, where, you know, an individual's shot records did not go with the soldier. In other words, in past conflicts, each soldier was required to carry a shot record in which all his vaccinations were entered into the shot record. And that was not true during Desert Storm. There were a lot of units that were lined up and told that if they didn't receive a vaccination, sometimes as many as 13 in one day, that they'd be court-martialed, or even in one case, they were told they'd be taken out and shot. And so that is shot not with a hypodermic needle, but shot with an M16.
Right.
So there were a lot of suspicious things that happened, and we have no way of knowing, because we can't, of course, get our hands on any of these lots of vaccines to actually test them. And
now, underscoring once again, the records of the vaccines that these soldiers received are no longer available?
Well, they weren't available at the time for some reason. In fact, in talking to some of the nurses that were trying to enter some of this information in the shot records, they were told by officers to stop doing it, and if they didn't stop, they'd be court-martialed.
Any thoughts about why that may have happened? Obviously, that to a savvy observer of national security affairs, that suggests that there was something to hide.
Well, there was, there were some comments from various people that various experimental vaccines were being used. Some were called recombinant vaccines, and of course now they're denying it. But yet, I've talked to individual officers who claim that they were flat out told that they were getting recombinant vaccines, and then it was later denied that anyone received recombinant vaccine. So, you know, we just don't know, frankly. We don't know what happened, and they're not being honest with us about what did happen.
Just one second.
Garth, this is Len Horowitz. I was just going to ask you, you might comment on what the possibility was for vaccine recipients, contaminated vaccine recipients, to have had subsequent immune dysfunction or immune suppression, which, you know, followed by chemicals and or drug interactions might have caused some of the symptoms.
Well, of course, a lot of the signs and symptoms that Gulf War illness patients have are really overlapping with a variety of different conditions. And so that makes it, difficult to, ascribe an illness to a particular cause. And they were exposed to a lot of chemicals. It was a very polluted battlefield. They were exposed, of course, to vaccines that they did not receive in proper sequence. In other words, they often received an initial vaccination and several boosters all on the same day, which is absolutely against all the protocols for vaccination. And when one does this, there is a chance that even attenuated vaccines can become a real infectious agent. And, you know, often the first type of vaccine you get will be a thoroughly killed vaccine, but sometimes they use attenuated versions later on where they'll give an attenuated partial live vaccine as a booster. But if you get it all at once, you're not capable of handling that booster, and that can turn into an infection instead of a vaccine. So that's, you know, a possibility, although we really don't know enough about the vaccines that they used, and that's a major problem.
Ed Haslam, do you have any thoughts or any or questions for Dr. Nicholson as you listen to this discussion?
Oh, I've been listening carefully, and it just, you know, it just reinforces the point. Once you've created these things, who do you put in control of them, and what system of supervision do we have on top of it? I mean, I don't really have any questions for him. I'm just sitting here scratching my head at here we go again.
Well, one of the things that comes to mind as I listen to this, much of the discussion that we have engaged in concerning either the iatrogenic or deliberate infection of people with apparently genetically engineered diseases, and we've kicked around AIDS, we've kicked around a soft tissue cancer epidemic that Ed Haslam has come up with in his book, Mary Ferry and the Monkey Virus. We've talked about Ebola, we've talked about Marburg, possibly also some of the factors figuring into chronic fatigue syndrome and other things. One of the things we focused on, though, concerns the experimental, it concerns using these vaccines, trial vaccines, and experimenting on what might be termed out-groups, groups of people who are considered alien from mainstream America or with disfavor by the conservative establishment. Yet here, whatever the possible means of infection of the troops, we're seeing, in essence, the flower of American youth and maybe the essence of American patriotism, namely the armed forces, being afflicted by some of these organisms. And so I think for those who, simply as a moral lesson or as a sociological lesson, I think for those who might be inclined to sit back and take a passive response to these, figuring, oh, well, I'm not black, I'm not gay, I'm not a junkie, I practice safe sex, and so I'm a nice little yuppie puppy with my one eye on my credit rating and the other eye on the door, and I don't give a damn, it's not going to happen to me. People might want to think again, because as I like to say on this program, in a political context, which now has a very sinister medical meaning, what goes around comes around.
Well, I think that's certainly true, and we're seeing it in the families of the soldiers that came back. And there are some reports on certain military bases that the school systems are now riddled with chronic fatigue-like signs and symptoms. And so it is beginning to spread. I think this is the real danger as part of any of these sorts of things. You cannot contain a biological. So these experiments, and I think there have been experiments going on for years, are uncontainable. And when they get loose, you cannot stop them. And that's what we're seeing, I think, over and over again. And you'd think these powers that be would learn their lesson on this issue, and they haven't learned it yet.
With AIDS, Dr. Nicholson, this is Alan Cantwell again. With AIDS, even though we did not know what caused AIDS from the very beginning, the government very clearly stated, the health authorities, that this disease was sexually transmissible very possibly, and that there was a possible danger in the sexual arena. Now, here you tell us that we're dealing with a disease that not only is communicable, perhaps even airborne, but...
It is airborne. It's an airborne pathogen.
But also a disease that may be sexually transmitted. Have these veterans, soldiers, been given any kind of medical advice from any government officials regarding sexuality?
No, they haven't.
How do you explain that?
Well, I think that they're trying to cover this all up. That's my feeling. There's no other way to really explain it, is that they do not want this information to be known, and they're willing to sacrifice 100,000 soldiers, their family members, to keep this quiet.
You know, Dr. Nicholson, you made a very interesting comment that they haven't learned their lesson. And my question is, I guess, to all of us here, is do they want to learn the lesson? And what I bring to forth is the fact that they knew the FDA and the powers that be knew as early as 1962 that the Salk-Sabin vaccines were contaminated, and as late as 1972, we have Freedom of Information Act documents that show that the oral polio vaccine, for instance, they knew was still contaminated, to this very day remains contaminated with monkey virus genes, cytomegalovirus genes, herpes virus types genes. Now, why, if they know this, do they continue to allow this to be, other than, and I'm just going to pop the theoretic question, this issue of population control, intentional reduction of human lives?
By the way, we might want to bring in, too, in that context, Len Rather, you came across a terrifying, by way of what goes of amplifying my what goes around comes around theme, you came across a terrifying study of recommendations for the U.S. population control.
Indeed, there was, you know, that you, Dave, I'm sure you, Garth, and Alan, and Ed, you all get photocopies of things people send you now all over the country. Well, about several months ago, somebody faxed me a sheet out of the July 1995 issue of the Council on Foreign Relations magazine, which was a plea to council members to recognize the urgent need to reduce the United States population by 55% down to 1947, 1948 levels. And so, again, what concerns me is somebody who's looked into the social political background, the milieu, as Dave, you mentioned it, and I find that it was A, Henry Kissinger, who ordered the development of these types of viruses, B, brought Eric Traub, Hitler's top biological weapons developer, over to the United States, C, was placed in that position by Lawrence Rockefeller, D, Lawrence Rockefeller sat on the board of the Sloan Foundation, which funded much of the research in this area, D, he sat on the board of the directors of the New York City Blood Council, the blood bankers who allowed the blood, contaminated as it was, they knew it, to be shipped because they didn't want to spend a lousy $150 million to clean it up. And
he also advised Merck Company.
Exactly, and so did Henry Kissinger, was a major consultant to Merck, Sharp & Dohme. And, you know, I look at this information, and the Rockefeller Foundation and the Sloan Foundation were intimately involved in funding the Population Control Council of the City of New York and all the population control people. They were also investing in the NOR plant studies, and, you know, again, that goes back to what Hazleton, the Dow Chemical Company president, had said, you know, we're really interested in protecting the ability of United States corporate America to continue to investigate these types of experiments on human lives without feeling the need to be under risk of plaintiffs' injuries. So it's like, to me, I look at this and I go, well, maybe they didn't want to learn the lesson because it's not a lesson that's out of their agenda. Any comments?
Yeah, well, I got a comment on that, and Len, I think that's very close to the bone in a lot of situations. What I see going on here that is similar to this laboratory in New Orleans in the early 1960s that I've been investigating is the misuse of national security in order to cut off public debate or to hide political accountability. And it kind of reminds me of a quote that Jim Garrison said, if the war powers refuse to be questioned about such actions, such as killing the president or running these type of medical things, then perhaps we should stop pretending that this is a government of the people. I mean, where is the public debate about whether any of these things are on the agenda or should be on the agenda of the United States?
Well, part of the issue is the fact that it is like you're looked at like a lunatic, except really for the Christian right. Nobody has embraced the notion that there is this thing called a New World Order. Meanwhile, there's no secret. It's incredible. The fact is that the mainstream media doesn't want to talk about Henry Kissinger's 1955 Harvard PhD thesis, which was called The Meaning of History, which clearly reflects the contemporary evolution of this New World Order.
Beyond that, I would just add that international fascism, if one really studies the bedrock factors behind World War II, one finds massive and profound collusion between many of the same corporate interests, the Rockefeller interests, for example, such as Standard Oil, the Chase Manhattan Bank, and many others, and the fascist powers of Europe. New World Order and the New Order were terms Hitler used explicitly.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Backtracking very briefly, we're going to have to wrap things up here in just a couple of minutes. I want to get a closing statement, sort of a summary statement from each of you, as well as, by the way, information for listeners as to where they can get more information about your books, articles, etc. Dr. Nicholson, backtracking very slightly, you've been talking about family members of Gulf War veterans getting these diseases. I believe also in some of your literature you mentioned that VA hospital physicians are getting them.
That's correct. We're getting, for the first time now, telephone calls from nursing and physician staff members in Veterans Administration hospitals and military hospitals that are coming down with this because they work in Gulf War illness referral units.
How many GIs have died, do you think?
Well, the estimates, and we don't have hard numbers on this, are between 12 and 15,000.
Yeah, these are veterans who've died of Gulf War syndrome?
Well, these are veterans who've died of unusual diseases since Operation Desert Storm. And by the way, there are a couple thousand of those that have died of cancers. And there are a lot of very unusual cancers represented, spinal cord cancers, brain tumors and stuff. And remember, this is an age group under 25, and you don't expect to see those types of cancers at such high frequency.
There are what, only 200-300 GIs actually killed in combat?
148, according to official records. But that's only the tip of the iceberg. There were some immediate casualties that weren't reported, and we found that out from Graves Registry units. And these immediate casualties are probably due to nerve agents or anthrax or something of that type, which had much more acute signs and symptoms. And they were, by the way, taken away, and often their dates of death were changed from what we heard. So they were doing a lot of very funny things during Operation Desert Storm, and if people found out about it, I think they'd be really shocked.
Again, by way of underscoring that it's not just outgroups, it's not just blacks, gays, drug users, hemophiliacs, or people on the periphery of society or viewed with disfavor by the right wing or conservative establishment that are exposed to this, that again, what goes around comes around.
And that concludes the interview with Dr. Garth Nicholson, who, along with his wife, Dr. Nancy Nicholson, has done some seminal work on the genetically engineered mycoplasma that appears to figure in much of Persian Gulf War syndrome. This interview with Dr. Nicholson was part of a broadcast radio symposium about genetic engineering and biological warfare, featuring Dr. Alan Cantwell, the author of, among other titles, AIDS and the Doctors of Death, Dr. Leonard Horowitz, the author of Emerging Viruses, AIDS and Ebola, Nature, Accident, or Intentional, Ed Haslam, the author of Mary Ferry and the Monkey Virus, and Dr. Garth Nicholson. This entire interview, as well as the other half-hour segments that I've produced, the various interviews I've been producing for the last couple of years, and now all of the archive shows as well, all of these are available from a tape duplication service called Spitfire. That's one word, S-P-I-T-F-I-R-E. You can reach them at Post Office Box 1179, P.O. Box 1179, that's in Ben Lomond, California, capital B-E-N, capital L-O-M-O-N-D, zip code 95005. Once again, the archive shows, the weekly One Step Beyond shows, the half-hour segments I've been producing for the last year and a half or so, and the various interviews that I've produced, including the October 20th, 1996 Symposium on Genetic Engineering and Biological Warfare, are available from Spitfire, P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, 95005. Their email address is alcalame@ix.netcom.com. alcalame@ix.netcom.com. That concludes this segment. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.